My first question is sort of an admission that there was just one thing I was disappointed with about the book.
Sure, what was that?
Just the title.
Oh.
If I Had Lunch with C.S. Lewis led me to think that perhaps this would be imagined lunches with Lewis and perhaps imagined dialogue on various ideas, somewhat like Peter Kreft's.
Yeah.
Between Heaven and Hell, something like that. But you chose not to do that. So
no,
tell me about why.
I'll tell you about that. Obviously, when you're negotiating with the C.S. Lewis company,
right.
You know, there are various issues that they want to be clear about. And I think they felt that there was a danger that some of the titles we were proposing came dangerously suggesting that I personally had lunch with Lewis and was reporting on this. So in the end, what we had to try and do was find a title which said, look, what we are doing, in effect, is imagining we're having lunch with Lewis, P.S., we haven't, but let's just imagine we are, and ask what sort of things would he say. And so the idea of the lunch is imagined, but we do not want to imagine what Lewis would say, because we know what Lewis would say.
Right.
So there's a sense in which the context is imaginary. In the UK version, we change it like that. You say, imagine that you're at Oxford having a tutorial with Lewis. You know, the key idea of lunch, but the amplifiers as well. But the real idea is to say, look, supposing we would sit down with Lewis, and instead of asking him things like, tell us about your mother, or things like that, we'll say, look, we want to learn from you, not learn about you. And that's something I picked up very much from the correspondence I got from the Lewis biography. A lot of people say they really like this biography. But when they start talking about why they like Lewis, the thing that kept coming up was this. He's our mentor. He's a guide. He's a travelling companion. You know, he's someone who really helps us. And they would say, well, look, you clarified this in the biography. Actually, it doesn't really matter to us at all. What we want to know is, what would Lewis say to us when we're thinking about this question of facing this situation? Now, I've got so many letters like that. And I've had so many conversations like that. And I thought, while all this material is fresh in my mind, why don't I, in effect, say, look, let's let Lewis talk to us about eight big questions.
Mm-hmm.
Eight because eight we've got to terms, it's not obvious thing to do. And it wasn't difficult to choose the eight. You know, they just leapt out, so to speak.
And a number of new creation.
Yes.
Eight.
Yes, well, that's right. It's a nice theme. And I personally think the book works okay. I think it kind of opens up
right.
Those questions as being important. And then it lets us see actually Lewis. A, that's something very interesting to say, and B, knew what he's talking about, and C, could help us as we think further about these things. So in many ways, what I was trying to do is to say to two groups of people, Lewis can help you. One is just Christians who are thinking about things. But we're also hoping that people who are just thinking about big questions would say, hey, you've heard of this guy, Lewis. Let's read this. And you'll notice at the end, I give terribly specific biographies in each chapter. It's only about... I mentioned that there are 3-4 books, and then there are these bits by Lewis, you should read these, and sometimes it's just chapters, you know, it's really trying to say, look, you know, go on and read Lewis and take this over.
Very good, very good. Well, out of the plethora of ideas from Lewis's whole corpus that you could have examined, why did you pick the 8 major ideas that you did?
Well, I think there's 2 main reasons. One is that I wanted to scope quite a wide range of topics, making sure I didn't just deal with intellectual issues, but with existential issues as well. So in other words, there's a sense in which I was trying to balance things like meaning of life, friendship, you know, these are quite different things. And I thought it would be nice to have a balance between thinking and doing, you know, and trying to make connections between thought and life. The other reason was I talked to an awful lot of people and I asked them, you know, what they took away from him. You know, what sort of things they found particularly helpful, and I noted the answers they gave. And actually, those were the 8 themes that bubbled up to the top of the list.
Okay.
So, in effect, it's not really my choice, even though actually I was very happy with the choice. It was really that these were the things that people seemed to want to listen to him about.
Interesting. So you really took them from what you were hearing from people in reaction to the biography.
That's and I felt there's a danger I will simply say, well, these are just me, so we're going to talk about it. And so I thought, well, actually, what I'm hearing of people is they're interested in these things. Mm. Well, let's go with that. If they're interested, he says a lot of these things, let's look at them.
Right. In the first chapter on meaning, you quote a favorite book of mine from many years ago, Viktor Frankl's Man's
Search. Oh, it's great. Yes, it keeps coming back.
And Frankl quotes Nietzsche, who said, "The person who has a why to live for can bear with almost any how." Mm-hmm. Do you think Lewis would have agreed with that? Where did Lewis believe we find meaning in life? Is meaning something that ultimately can be found only by the Christian?
Yes. Well, as I look at Lewis's writings from his early period, in the sort of early 20s, you know, I see him, in effect, just saying, let's get on with it. He's thinking deep thoughts. But he has not found the answers, but he realizes he just has to keep going. And I think that one of the things I do notice is that, if I could use a strange phrase, this sort of existential buoyancy about Lewis from his conversion onwards, where actually, you know, he becomes much more settled, much more at home. It's as if his life is falling into place. You know, you think about things that are happening around that time. I mean, whether he got converted in 29 or 30, you know, by 1930, you know, he's settled into belief in God, he's about to become a Christian, his family life is beginning to settle down, Warren is coming back, you know, it's as if his life is really beginning to get anchored firmly. And what I notice is that once Lewis is firmly anchored, the really big books begin to appear. And so what I think here is that Lewis really does think meaning is important. You've got to sort things out. You can't do anything unless you've really got answers to life questions. And I think that Lewis himself found two things. One was, A, Christianity really did give a rather good answer. But B, that Lewis was looking for what I call, using Bowlby's phrase, a secure base. Something on which he could base his life, figure out who he was, what he was meant to be doing, and getting on with it. And I think that's probably true of most of us, you know, that actually we really do need to think about these things. And one of the points I try and make is that Lewis is just saying to us that you've got to think about these things. You can't just say, oh, let's just keep going and not think. Really, you know, letting Lewis challenge us to ask, well, have you found that answer?
Do you think, I mean, this gets at Christ being the only way, and I think I know your answer to that, but do you think Lewis could have found meaning apart from Christianity?
He could have found some limited meaning. And actually, I sense, you know, if you look at his letters describing his joy at, you know, looking at Arthur Rackham's book on Wagner,
right.
you know there's something there, but didn't prove enough. You know, there was something, but it was only part of the picture, not the full picture. And what I would say is that whatever I think that Lewis found that Christianity gave a picture which A is right and B is the best. I think that really is very, very important for him. Because Lewis was intellectually restless. You know, he kept on thinking and wrestling with things. And my sense is that actually, as I read his writings, that restlessness is expressed in exploring Christianity more deeply, not exploring alternatives. And he sorted out what the big answer is. Now he wants to make sure he's fully understood it and appreciated.
Good. Second chapter on friendship. I think one of the wonderful things about your book is that you bring many other friends to lunch with Lewis as dialogue partners, and one of those is Aristotle. Do you believe that Lewis's understanding of friendship was grounded in Aristotle? How might Lewis have differed from Aristotle on this topic?
Well, I think Lewis studied classics, so in effect there's a sense in which Aristotle would have been one of his companions, you know, at one point. And I think that it was inevitable that Lewis would engage with classical ideas of what friendship's all about. But I sense that's just a starting point. Actually, really, really Lewis is saying this is important, but there's a lot more to it than that. And I think that he finds that more explicitly Christian ways of thinking about friendship are actually very important as well. Some of his ideas on friendship, I have to say, I think fit into Christianity quite well. I'm not sure if they're explicitly Christian in terms of their origins, but you can see how he weaves them together rather well.
Right, right. Chapter 3, you focus on the importance of story for Lewis, and you begin by asking the reader, which story are you in? What is the predominant story that you think shapes most people in the world today, and how does this story differ from that which Lewis invites us to look at?
Yeah, it's a very good question. I've had a lot of letters from people saying that what you said there made us stop and think. You know, because they had never thought we implicitly have a way of thinking about things, and suddenly realizing that we've actually bought into something without realizing it.
Yes.
It's very important. But going back to that, I think that one of the things that really matters here is that most people have bought into, almost unconsciously, a way of thinking about the world as not really meaningful, life's not really meaningful, but we're here, let's just get on with it, let's do the best we can, and that's it. And it's all very pragmatic secularism, I suppose, I don't know what you call it. And in many ways, what I'm trying to do in that chapter is to say, look, that's just one way of looking at things, there are others. Let's look at Lewis's way. And B, one of the best ways of making people wake up and realize they are in a story whether they like it or not is to tell them a better story.
Mm.
And they suddenly realize, that this makes more sense. This is actually more exciting. That this really, if it is true, it's going to move in a very different direction. That could be rather exciting. Mm. And that's one of the reasons why I draw on Lewis's sermon and The Weight of Glory, because he talks there about, in effect, the world being enchanted with the wrong spell. We need to break that spell so people can see things as they really are. And I thought that's one of the most interesting things he wrote. And I thought it would be good just to see how Lewis, in effect, uses the Chronicles of Narnia to tell a better story and make you realize there are other ways of looking at things.
It occurs to me that H.G. Wells would have been very influential for Lewis, as one of the great storytellers Lewis's early years, and then Lewis coming to a different position and seeing how powerful Wells's storytelling was, and let's tell a different story.
Exactly. No, you're absolutely right. And I think that's what Lewis is doing in the what do you call space?
The cosmic trilogy. Yeah.
I mean, and maybe what Lewis is saying is, look, H.G. Wells shows us that telling these stories are great, but the problem is, look at the message he's trying to get across. Let me use the same medium, but give a very different message. And actually, more and more people are reading those. I'm surprised how many people in Oxford are coming back to them and rereading them. So that's encouraging, I think.
Good. Let's see. Chapter 4, you zero in on the topic of Aslan and the Christian life. And you especially focus on Freud's idea of God as a wish fulfillment and Lewis's answer to this. Do you think Lewis wrestled with this in his personal life? What I mean to say is, do you think Lewis bought into Freud's ideas as an atheist and then changed his mind?
He did buy into Freud's idea, either directly or indirectly. I mean, I think that was just the way he was as a young man. And I think that if you read Surprised by Joy, one of the most interesting things is to notice how much he emphasizes that he didn't come to believe in God because of some kind of wish fulfillment thing. It's something much deeper than that. Do you remember that? It's like the mouse looking for the cat. And he's very, very clear that he does not conform to a Freudian stereotype. But I think he is alert to the fact that many of his readers will have bought into this way of thinking. And therefore Lewis clearly wants to say, look, if I had a reader who had bought into that way of thinking, how could I help them break free from it? And I think that one of the things he's trying to do in his use of Aslan is to say, look, this is no invention, this is the way things really are. The problem is we have not fully appreciated this. Mm. And I think his use of Aslan is just one of the best things he does. And I'm just full of admiration for that.
Mm. So. Mm. I love his letter to Sheldon Van Alken, I think his first letter to Van Alken, where he says, you know, we have wishes on both sides, so what we wish for doesn't really prove anything, so let's just set that aside.
Yeah.
Good. In chapter 5, you talk about the art of apologetics. I like that title. Do you think Lewis viewed apologetics as an art, and if so, how did he go about his apologetics in an artistic manner?
I think he did see it as an art, although I have to say I cannot quote a text which proves that. It's more sort of a feeling, you know, from reading him. And also, I mean, it's a skill or a discipline that Lewis learned the hard way. You know, he clearly felt, look, I'm an atheist who's become a Christian, and actually I know why I chose Christianity, and I know the arguments I used to use against Christianity, and I think I might also help others who are in that place move on using my own experience. And I think myself that what we see is Lewis in effect doing this from the 30s onwards, but doing it better and better. I mean, I would say he peaks in the 40s, but really that's the golden age of Lewis as an apologist. And what I see him doing is really trying to do a number of things. One is to make sure he's able to translate his ideas into ordinary language. And again, he learns that the hard way by going around these Air Force bases in the early 40s. And I think also, he's also trying to work out what story can I tell, what image can I use. Because quite often, Lewis apologetics basically takes form of try seeing it this way. You know, his defense of the Doctrine of Trinity is not traditional dogmatic defense. It's much more saying, well, look, we're like people living in a two-dimensional world trying to describe three-dimensional reality. Do you see that? You know, when you start looking at it that way, the problem does seem rather different. So I think Lewis ends up actually being a very successful apologist. Very good reasoned arguments, a very good appeal to the imagination, a very good ability to translate theology into the vernacular. And what I notice with great interest is that there are people who hugely value Lewis's rational arguments, but miss the fact that actually he appeals to the imagination as well.
Right.
And I think one of the things I try to do in that chapter is just say, look, there's a real richness to Lewis here. There are many levels at which he works. Let's just make sure we grasp them and see if we can learn from them.
Now, you come from a background in science. Do you think there's a difference in the way maybe you or others coming from that background approach apologetics as opposed to an artistic approach?
That's a very good question. I think the answer is yes and no. I think, yes, there is clearly a difference because as a scientist, you know, the key question you're going to ask would be, what is the reason for thinking this is right? And Lewis does ask that question at several points, but his predominant way of thinking is more to do with, in effect, making you say, look, if this were true, it would be wonderful. And by the way, there are very good reasons for thinking it is true. You know, Lewis creates a desire and then shows it's not random or arbitrary. But there is that very interesting manuscript in the Wade collection, Early Prose Joy.
Mm.
And in it, Lewis says, I am an empirical theist. I came to faith by induction. And what he means by that is that he said, look, here's what I observe and experience. Here's the Christian way of looking at things. Actually, they map onto each other. It's almost as if he's saying, empirically, this way of thinking is deeply satisfying. And actually, that is the way a scientist would think. And so there are points in which Lewis, whether he realizes it or not, actually does fit in quite well to a scientific way of thinking.
Good. Let's see. Chapter 6 on education. You call The Abolition of Man the most boring title ever invented for a book. How do you think Lewis might have better titled it, and what's Lewis what's his basic message for us about education?
I think it's the subtitle of this, the double bit, really.
Right, right.
But it's one of those books. If you look at book sales, in terms of Lewis's writings, that's pretty low down. Mm. It's a shame, because actually I think it's one of the best.
Do you have an idea, based on your research, how many copies you have
sold? I know that one publisher keeps threatened with our print because the numbers keep going so low. Mm. But I don't know what the actual numbers are, but right. It is low.
So publishers don't like to give out those numbers.
No, they don't really. Pilgrim's Regress also is pretty low down.
Right.
But it's pretty because both of those books, I think, are very, very good. What I think is good about the abolition of man is that, in effect, Lewis just says, look, there are certain assumptions that inform modern educational thinking, and there are assumptions about human nature, about God, and about what the good really is. And I think what Lewis does splendidly is to critique what are really very shallow approaches to education, and in effect set out, although only quite briefly, a better way of doing it. And then elsewhere in his writings, he amplifies that. But I think one of the things that I really appreciated in that book was where Lewis, in effect, says, look, these modern educationalists are saying, be critical about what you think. Except, of course, when you're reading us, when we just want you to accept us. You know, in effect, Lewis is saying, you've got to be consistent about this. But what I think that book does is really almost nail the big question of the day, because remember, it's written during the Second World War. Mm. And one of the things that Lewis is saying in that book is, look, we are saying that Hitler is evil and we ought to fight him, and yet on the other hand we are deconstructing the idea of evil because we've got no moral framework that allows us to say this is good, this is evil. We can't go on like this. I just thought that is so prescient. You know, he's nailed that. He's really put his finger on a big problem which is still a problem today.
And of course, he pictures that battle in that hideous strength in such a wonderful way.
It really mattered to him. I mean, for Lewis, and of course Tolkien as well, the conflict between good and evil really, really matters. And what he was saying is our culture has lost its moral compass, so it's not actually able to name good and evil anymore. And I'm with him.
I love that scene in That Hideous Strength where Mark Studdick is taken into the room that has all the strange pictures in it, and it's like they've pushed things a step too far. They're hoping that this is going to ease him into their evil camp, but it actually makes him react and long for the good. And that's such a counterintuitive sort of picture.
It's a very counterintuitive picture, but I've met people who actually have made that journey. You know,
right.
Who in effect have thought, oh, well, no good, no evil, and something happens. When they say, hold on a minute, there's something wrong here. You know, it's almost as if they suddenly realize that this can't be right.
Right, right. Chapter 7, on the problem of pain, you say that pain is, I like this, not a puzzle, but rather a mystery. What do you mean by that? Do you think Lewis, does he tend to treat pain as a puzzle in the problem of pain? Does he eventually realize it's a mystery in A Grief Observed?
I think he treats it as a puzzle in the problem of pain. But I think one of the issues may be that actually the guy who edited the series may have said to him, look, can you approach the problem this way? So
right.
It may be Lewis's particular way of doing it. It may have been that this was forced on him by the way the series was set up. So I don't want to be too judgmental here. But there's no doubt that Lewis is treating pain in a very different way in The Problem of Pain and in Grief Observed. And I personally felt that actually this distinction in puzzle and mystery, which isn't original to me, it's quite a well-known distinction, actually does capture, I think, quite a good way of looking at the issue and helps us understand how Lewis moved on his thinking. We can live with a mystery. It's just saying that it's too big for us to take in. A puzzle, we expect to be able to solve it. And if we can't solve it, we say there's something wrong. You know, and what Lewis is really saying is, look, we're never going to be fully able to make sense of this, but we can grasp that. We can make enough sense of things to keep going, even though we can't see the full picture. There's enough there to keep us going, even though we can't see the full thing. And that's where Lewis ends up in A Grief Observed, especially, you know, where he just begins to think, you know, if I just wish someone could have born joys, pain. You know, if I could have done that, actually, isn't that what happened in the crucifixion? You know, that line of thought just beginning to edge his way towards something that isn't actually solving the problem, but it's giving him something, saying, actually, I can hold on to that, and that's enough. And actually, one of the things I like about Lewis is that as he gets older, he becomes much more willing to live with questions. You don't need neat solutions to everything. You know, if the big picture is good enough, that will keep you going. But there are points where the shadowlands remain, but you see them more clearly than you otherwise might.
Yesterday, I took a little personal journey to a little village in Gloucestershire called Maisie Hampton.
Oh, right.
Because my ancestors come from there, and there's a monument in the church to one of my ancestors.
Oh, how nice.
And it was his son that went to Virginia Colony in 1640.
Right.
That's, my descent comes from there. Anyway, I met this the parish priest, and she we got talking afterwards, and I told her that I'd written some things about C.S. Lewis, and she said, "Well, have you read Alistair McGrath's biography?" I said, "Yes, I have. I'm meeting with him tomorrow." And she was astonished, and she said, "Right now, I'm trying to read The Problem of Pain, and I'm having a terrible difficult time understanding it." What would you say to someone like that who wants to understand Lewis, but maybe finds him in some of his books speaking above their heads?
Yes, I think what you have to say is that one of the important things about Lewis is that you keep coming back to him. I still find that when I read a book, even for the sixth, seventh time, I find things I missed the first time.
Right.
You know? And secondly, there are points which Lewis is genuinely difficult to understand, or unpersuasive. And The Problem of Pain, I think, is one of those. It's not an easy book to read. You know, the introductory section where Lewis sets out, why is a Christian rather than an atheist, and then leads into the discussion of pain. I mean, it's interesting, but it will lose some readers. And one of the reasons I tried to write that chapter was, in effect, just feeling, look, we need someone to introduce Lewis on this, because it's actually quite difficult to do it if you're approaching it for the first time. So what I hope is that chapter will give you a framework to help you make more sense of The Problem of Pain and The Grief Observed.
Right, that's good. Chapter 8, you talk about Lewis and the hope of heaven.
Mm.
N.T. Wright criticizes Lewis a bit for having his ideas of heaven influenced, he thinks, by Plato, perhaps more than the Bible. Could you talk a little bit about how Lewis's ideas of heaven maybe were influenced by Plato, and comment on whether you think it's legitimate for a Christian to have their theology influenced by a non-Christian in that way?
Well, I think Lewis's early thinking on heaven, Pilgrim's Regress, good example, it's not necessarily Platonic, but it is this idea that heaven is a realm that exists independently of us and helps us to make sense of the realm in which we are. And obviously, I mean, a lot of Lewis scholars, I'm sure, would disagree with me, but as I read Lewis, the works in the 30s are really saying, for me, I like the idea of heaven very much because it helps me make sense of the world in which I live. It gives me a framework for looking at things. Now, that is a bit Platonic. Then Lewis begins to change his mind. Now, I'm not sure when this happens. I mean, it clearly has happened by the end of his life, but it's very difficult for me to put the trajectory together. But in some of his earlier writings, he in effect says, look, it's more important to believe in heaven than to hope you get there. Mm-hmm. By the end of his life, he's saying, actually, it's really important to get there. You know, it really has become not just a sense-making device, but an object of hope. This is where I want to be. And it may be that Lewis, as he got older, began to think more about this. It may be that particularly in the last couple of years of his life, this really changed the way that he thought about things. But I would say that by the end of his life, you know, Lewis has a very, very strong hope in heaven. And some of his letters from the final years of his life, I think, express that hope very, very well.
And yet there was a struggle there. I find the contrast interesting between what he says in A Grief Observed. Granted, his grief is clouding things a bit. But he has that line where he says, you know, the idea of reunion with those we've loved, it all comes out of bad hymns and and paintings and this sort of thing. You know, it's not in the Bible. And yet, in The Last Battle, that's exactly what he pictures is his reunion.
Yeah, and it's a classic example. And a lot of early Christian writers, such as McCarthy's, developed this idea, you know, that heaven is about being reunited, A, with God in Christ, and B, with our brothers and sisters have gone before us. You know, and it's like a family reunion. You know?
Right.
And actually, it's deeply embedded in the Christian tradition. And Lewis seems to lack it at certain points and not lack it at others.
Mm.
And sometimes I think it's one of these things that Lewis is still thinking through and hasn't quite made up his mind on. And with Narnia, sometimes I think he in effect chooses an image he thinks is going to work very well, even though I'm not absolutely sure he thinks that's the right image to use. But you're right. I mean, people have criticized him for having a platonic idea of heaven, and I share that concern. In the early writings, I think this is simply about heaven is a realm of ideas which makes sense of the world in which we exist. Mm. But he does move on.
Mm. Do you think maybe in A Grief Observed, maybe the expression there is one of, maybe he was going through a period where he was suddenly afraid that he'd been taken in and didn't want to be.
Well, you know.
So let's step back from this a moment and.
That's an interesting thought.
And where do we find ourselves if we can't believe in this idea of reunion? Yes, I'll be reunited with God, but what that means for all our other relationships, I don't know.
Well, he does make it clear that he in effect considered all options, you know, in A Grief Observed. His wife,
right.
It's a difficult book to read,
right.
You know, and certainly this idea that Christianity was just a sort of consoling myth. I mean,
right.
I mean, he obviously wrestled with that, not in the sense that he expected to find that was the case, but rather because he felt he had to. You know, to intellectual honesty demanded he did so. So I think it is quite a harrowing book to read.
Yes.
And I think it's one of these books where I think it's good to talk to somebody before you read it, because they can set it in context and help you understand what's going on.
Right. It has an astringent quality to it.
It does. And also, I mean, I have a friend who didn't read it all. Found quite a difficult book, and so in fact got to the very, very radical Dalton bits and didn't go any further. You know, I have to say, look, you know, you've got to see Lewis as being on a journey here where he's thinking all his dark thoughts and confronting all his fears and resolving them, and you've got the confronting bit but not the resolving bit.
Sometimes I've been afraid to give that book to someone who's grieving,
and yet
almost universally, the response I've heard, even when I really didn't expect it from someone, you know, maybe someone not even on Lewis's intellectual level, and who is, but who reads that and is going through grief, and they find it comforting.
Well, they find Lewis's description of grief chimes in.
Yes.
So I can trust this.
They relate.
So they'll keep going. And I know exactly what you mean, and I have friends who really benefit from it. And yet I feel a sense of anxiety because I know it's not an easy book to read.
Right.
But if it's helpful, well, great.
My mother-in-law passed away in 2010, and totally unbeknownst to me, my father-in-law read A Grief Observed. I didn't give it to him. He read it and he said, "That's an amazing book." I felt like he was describing my experience.
It is an amazing book. And in fact, you can see why he used the pseudonym to begin with, because you would not recognize it as C.S. Lewis at that first, I think. You know,
right. The Although T.S. Eliot did.
He did, yeah. Yes, he did. He thought the proposed pseudonym was obvious. The Midius and Divorces.
Yes, yes. In fact, I was looking in the Bodleian at the manuscript of A Grief Observed, the one with Domitius on it, and then the later versions where that's crossed out, and W. Clark. Very interesting. If you could meet Lewis for lunch today, what one question would you most want to?
Oh, you are difficult to
ask.
So many.
Well, you can say more than one.
Well, no, I know what you mean. There's so much I'd like to talk to him about. And I want to begin by saying how much he helped me. You know, actually, you know, I suppose all of us have mentors who help us. And actually, you know, Lewis was very, very important to me and still is. So I'd want to begin by saying, look, I know zillions of people have said this to you, but, you know, you've been very helpful to me.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the questions I would genuinely like to ask him is this. I mean, I know you're dead now, but... but 50 years after your death, culture's changed enormously. If I were to describe to you what the cultural situation is like now, what would your advice to us be? I mean, I know you did in your day, but what's your hunch for what we should do in ours? I have no idea what he would say. One of the most disappointing things about Lewis is that in many ways here in England, the things began to go badly wrong in 63 with John Robinson's Honest to God.
Right.
And of course Lewis was really ill, and so his little article in that isn't quite as good as it might be.
Right.
But you know, you know, what would Lewis say to us today? You know, I'd just love to know that.
On one occasion I was with Douglas Gresham here in Oxford, and I asked him, what do you think Jack would say if he were here in Oxford with us today? And Doug said, I think he would think he had woken up in hell. That it was...
Yes, it has to be.
He would recognize, you know, many things, obviously, but so changed culturally that...
Yes. And again, if you go back to the abolition of man, of all the things Lewis was worrying about there have happened.
Mm.
And the thing that really worries me is it's virtually impossible to, you know, reverse them.
Right.
So that's a concern.
So what are you working on next?
Oh, well, the answer is my professional field now is science and religion, so that's the major topic.
Mm-hmm.
I may sometime come back to C.S. Lewis in science and religion, because it's very interesting. But in the short term, it's very much... you know, major issues in relationship science and religion. But one thing I can tell you is that I've agreed with Oxford I will give a course of lectures on C.S. Lewis for undergraduates starting next year.
Oh, very good.
Just to, you know, say to them, look, you've got to take this guy seriously. Here's why he's important theologically, in a literary sense, apologetically. You know.
Has there been anything like that here?
Hasn't, you see. There hasn't. I know, it sounds astonishing.
Isn't that amazing?
It hasn't, but there will be.
Well, maybe because we've been too close to him.
I think that's it. I think there comes a point where, in effect, it becomes okay.
Because he's a part of the history.
So I think this is the right time to start.
It was sort of like my experience of reading J. Gresham Machen at Princeton.
Yes.
Where they could actually talk about him in a class because it was so much in the past that it was safe now to put him back in history.
Yes.
Very good. Well, thank you.
Well, I hope the rest of your trip goes really well.